We are holding on Tess Vov Omud Beis, eight lines from the bottom, nine lines from the bottom, line begins with Chala. Okay, we discussed yesterday about the idea that you're not allowed to sell various kinds of weapons to Goyim, which we're going to deal with in more detail later on. You're not allowed to sell them weapons, and we talked about you're also not allowed to sell such things to a Kusi, because a Kusi has no problem with turning around and sell it to a Goy. We talked about yesterday, Kusim are careful about certain mitzvahs, but one thing they're not careful about is the whole concept of Lifnei Iver, so they have no problem, they would have a problem, they wouldn't commit murder themselves, we said yesterday, therefore you're allowed to be in Yichud with them, but they would have no problem making it possible for somebody else to do so. They don't understand the Pasuk, Lifnei Iver, Leisit and Michshol. In that sense, they understand it in the literal sense of actually not putting a something in front of a blind person or trip over it.
Before they were
goes on, yeah, I mean, it could even be after they were goes on them. The point, I mean, generally we say that they're considered like goyim for all purposes, but the pashtus we're talking about before.
Yeah. I mean, they understand the Torah, like goyim. Would the Torah make, you know, a special pasuk to say don't put a stone in front of somebody?
Okay, you could argue, they could argue that that's what the Torah is saying. Anyway, that's the bottom line. Okay, fine. So now, Omer of Dimi Ba'aba, Kederach Sha'osu Limkol Ovid Kefavim, just as we're saying you're not allowed to sell these kinds of weaponry to Goyim,
right.
The same thing, Osu Limkol Lelistim Yisrael, you're also not allowed to sell such things to a Jewish bandit. So the question is, Hey Chidomi, well, what's the scenario with this Jewish bandit? Id Choshed Dekotil, if he suspects that not only he steals, but he also kills, Chidain Ovid Kefavim. Well, obviously then, in that case, he's on the same level as a Goy, there's the same problem, a Goy is going to use it for murder, a Jew is also going to use it for murder, so what's the difference? The Id Aloy Kotil, and if he's not the kind who kills, he's only the kind who steals, am I Aloy, then what's the problem? Why shouldn't you be able to sell him weapons? Maybe you should be allowed to sell it to him. The answer is lo'olam d'lo kotel. We are talking the Dimi Ba'aba is talking about the kind of listim, the kind of Jewish listim who doesn't kill. However, v'hachav mayaskin and v'mashmuta. However, we're talking about the kind of listim who grabs something from the owner and runs away. A typical listim is the kind who he hides by the side of the road or whatever, and then jumps out and demands money or whatever. Here we're talking about the kind who operates more by stealth. So he grabs it and runs away. If you run after him, he will try to fight back to protect himself.
What do you call that?
So we're calling that mashmuta. Mashmuta meloshon shoymit, because he tries to grab away things from people. In other places in the Gemara, sometimes we refer to such a person as a ganav more than a gazlan, because that's the thing. Usually, the definition of a gazlan, usually a listim and gazlan are almost synonymous. Usually, a gazlan is one who does it openly, and a ganav is one who does it secretly. Right. So over here, the point is, sometimes he will use weapons when he feels he needs to protect himself, when people are running after him to get their stuff back or whatever. Therefore, that's the point. In other words, he's the kind of guy, therefore, that you're not allowed to sell to him, even though he's not suspect under normal circumstances of killing, but in extreme circumstances, he might use the weapons for that, and therefore it's awful. As opposed to if he's the kind who doesn't kill at all, then yeah, you would be allowed to sell him to him. And if he's the kind who regularly does kill, then of course you're not allowed to sell it to him. Turn it up on him. We learn in a brayse some more on this topic of selling weapons to goyim. Ein moichin lahem trisin. You're not allowed to sell shields to goyim. Yeshayim moichin lahem trisin. On the other hand, yeshayim, which usually means usually yeshayim in the Gemara, usually in a brayse, it usually means Reb Nosson, says you are allowed to sell them shields. So the question is, my time, what's the problem with selling them shields according to the Tanakh? I think it's a Greek or Latin word. I think, I don't remember. But yeah, it's a common word in Hebrew for a shield. Shloisha Tristan Hain in the Mishnah stuff we learned for a Yahrzeit. We're gonna see. Wait. So my time. So why should you not be allowed to sell them shields? Ilema Mishum de Magnu Alayu. Is it just because they use them for self defense? And you're going to argue that you're not even allowed to, not only you're not allowed to sell them weapons that you can use, that they can use to kill, but you're not even allowed to sell them something for self-defense. The problem is, then in that case, by that logic, you shouldn't be allowed to sell them wheat or barley either. You shouldn't be allowed to sell them anything. why should wheat and barley be any different than the wheat and barley also? They can use that. No, obviously not, but they can use them. An army travels on its stomach, right? I mean, if you're going to argue you can't sell them shields because they can use them for defensive purposes, then by that logic, you shouldn't be allowed to sell anything to a Goyish soldier. And we know that's not the case. Omar Rav, so Rav answers, E. Epsher, if in fact it is possible, If it is possible to avoid selling any kind of supplies to armies, E is the same as Im, basically. That's what it says over here in Hagos, it's your name, that E is sometimes means Im. Im, E is the Aramaic word for it. E, Epsher, if it is possible, Hachinami, then indeed, that's so. Ideally, you shouldn't be selling them anything that they can use as part of their war effort, whether offensive or defensive. If there's a problem of Ava, fine, then you can't get away with it, then you have to sell them wheat and barley, but at least you can avoid selling them shields, says Rav. Ikadamri, then there's another version, that they say, Trisin Hainu Taima Deloi, that there's a different reason, not that in principle you're not allowed to sell them something defensive, but according to the second version, Trisin Hainu Taima Deloi, the reason why the Tanakhama would say you're not allowed to sell them shields, because the shields can also be used offensively. Because when they run out of weapons, when they run out of arrows, and their swords are broken or whatever, when this is all they have left, they kill using the shield. So that answers your question. We're talking about metal shields over here. The edges of a metal shield make a good weapon if you have nothing else. Yeah, to bash them in, whatever. Yeah. On the other hand, the Yesh Omrim who say that you are allowed to sell them shields, the argument is because they don't use them for offensive purposes. To kisholim zainaihu, when they run out of weapons, miarak arki, then they're just going to run away. We don't figure that they're going to use their shields like that as weapons of last resort. So that's all. It's not a machloikus about whether you're allowed to sell them something defensive. It's a question, is a shield considered an offensive weapon or not? Okay. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Avu, halacha ki yesh omrim. So the halacha is like the yesh omrim, you are allowed to sell them shields. Okay. Amar Rav Adabar.
How do they explain that?
So that's again because the Yesh Omrim said, because they don't use their shields as weapons. They use them as defense. They use them for defensive purposes. And if a Goyish soldier, if all he has left is his shield, he has no more sword and he has no more arrows or whatever else they use, then he would run away. He's not going to use his shield. He'll use his shield to defend himself. He's not going to use it to go and bash the other guy. Therefore, the Yesh Omrim say there's no possibility that the Goy is going to use it for the, not no possibility, but a very, very, very remote possibility that the Goy is going to end up using it for an offensive weapon, and therefore there's no problem selling it. Okay, now halachas like that. Amar of Adabahaba, Ein Moichin Lahen Ashoshiyas Shel Barzel. Here's another din. You're not allowed to sell them big chunks of metal. So the question is, so what's the reason? Mishum Dechalshi Minayu Klei Zayin. Because all they need to do then is they can take these big chunks of metal and bang them with a hammer to thin them out, and then you can make weaponry out of them. So again, the question is, now, by the way, Meforshim talk about, so what about lifne to lifne? We said before is allowed. It's an indirect thing. And the answer is, because here it's more lifne to lifne. We said before, you're allowed to do something. You're allowed to sell something to a goy where then he may, let's say, turn around and sell it to another goy who will use it for avodah zarah or whatever. By the same logic here, you sell him a chunk of metal, which he can then flatten out and make into weapons. Shouldn't that be lifne to lifne? And the answer is that no, because it's basically practically already formed. All it needs to be done is flattened out, and presto, you have a weapon. So it's not really a lifne to lifne. It's more of a direct thing. Okay, but the question with that is, by that logic, then you shouldn't be allowed to sell them shovels or spades either. Same idea. You know, you have the famous expression from Tanakh, they'll beat their swords into plowshares, which is on the wall of the UN, Mashamam, but whatever, you know. So here it's the other way around. They can take the plowshares and beat...
The other way around. They plowed into...
Whatever. The point is that they can take shovels and things like that and beat them into swords, yeah. Amr of Zvid. So Zvid says, we're not just talking about any kind of metal over here. We're talking about the parzala in Devar. We're talking about Indian iron. Indian iron was good, high quality iron. It was
Indian meaning from India.
Indian meaning from India. Obviously, it doesn't mean from American Indians. Yeah. And no, I mean, Indian as in from India, yeah. In those days, they had a very high quality, iron industry, metalworking industry over there. And in particular, they made iron that was exceptionally good for weapons. And therefore, when you... Maybe it was steel. Those kinds of chunks of metal, which are...
Hindu is one way, but you could say it's hardened.
Okay, but that's what it means. Parakala Hindava means high quality iron that comes from India, which therefore, in other words, it's high quality. It's used specifically for weapons. So therefore, you have a real problem that they're going to flatten it out and make weapons out of it. Whereas if you sell them, let's say, an ordinary shovel or whatever, yeah, of course they could go and turn it into steel, etc. But we're not worried about that already. That's a little too far fetched. Okay. However, the Gemara says, about all this that we've been talking about not selling weapons to Goyim, v'ha'idna d'kamez abninan, what do we do? So how about nowadays, though, we see that in the later times of the Gemara, we sell weapons. Nowadays, when the Gemara was written, we see that Jews do sell weapons to Goyim. How is it allowed? Amar Rav Ashi, l'parsoi d'magnu ilavon. Because we're selling it to the Persians who protect us, meaning we're citizens of the Persian Empire. They need weapons in order to guard the cities, in order to guard the country or whatever against internal and external enemies. So therefore, we're allowed to sell it to them because it's all part of our own. It's part of our own protection. So even though they're over the Kachavim, yeah. So that's the thing. Again, I mentioned yesterday you have different categories of dinim in these things. Some of them are some of the dinim we have in these prakim refer to whether the goy is an oved avodah zarah or not. Some of them refer to whether they're immoral or not. Some of them refer across the board to goyim. Here we're saying it's a matter of because they're immoral and therefore they use it for murder. Well, therefore, the parsoi who are using it for the defense of the cities and of the country, that's allowed. And Tosfos says, for the same reason, nowadays we're allowed to sell weapons to Goyim for the same reason, because again they use it for defensive purposes to defend the cities and the countries where we live. They could also use them for other purposes, unfortunately, but the fact is they could also use them to defend the cities, and therefore it's allowed. I saw an interesting discussion in this question. They talk about the question nowadays when Israel sells armaments to countries all over the world. Is that allowed based on our Gemara over here? They do. One argument actually is that a lot of what they sell is defensive stuff, and we've established defensive stuff you're allowed to sell. But there's certain military planes and whatever So based on what we're saying over here, first of all, anything defensive we're saying is allowed. Even offensive weapons, we're saying if they're selling it to countries that also have Jewish populations, for example, the United States or the European countries or whatever, then that's one thing. If they sell them to countries that don't have much of a Jewish presence, that's a different question. Okay. All right. The Mishnah continued. Agolim Musyachim. We said in the Mishnah that when it comes to selling large animals to Goyim, we said you're not allowed to. And the Tanakhama had said you're not allowed to sell them whether they're mature animals or young animals, because eventually young animals grow up, and whether they're whole or whether they're healthy or whether they're broken, have a broken leg or whatever. And we said, Rabbi Yehuda said you're allowed to sell them an animal with a broken leg. Tanya, so we learn in a braisa. Rabbi Yehuda matir b'shvura. Rabbi Yehuda says you're allowed to sell them an animal with a broken leg. Because it's not going to heal afterwards. So therefore, we have a strong reason to assume that the guy bought it in order to shecht it and eat it. He's not going to keep it around expecting it to heal, and then he's going to end up doing work with it, which we said yesterday is going to be a problem. And therefore, also Rashi points out the goy is not going to keep it around for any length of time. So there's not a problem that another yid is going to see this animal in the goy's house and figure, hey, you're allowed to sell such animals to goyim because the goy is not going to, if he buys an animal with a broken leg, he's going to shecht it within the next couple of days. What else is he going to do with it?
Why would you do that today? You can heal them.
Okay, so if you can heal them, I guess that's different. Okay, maybe that's different. I mean, we said that today anyway. We're makel on these dinim for various reasons, as we discussed before. Okay. Omru loy, so the Chachamim said to him, okay, but what makes you say that the goy is going to right away shech the animal? After all, such an animal, you're able to breed it, assuming it's a female animal, and therefore the goy may keep it around so that it'll give birth to babies. Since you're able to breed it, and it will end up having children, because, or Tosfos says, by the same logic, it's a male animal, you're also able to breed it. Then the goy is likely to keep it around. L'shahuya, he's likely to keep it around. Also l'shahuya, he may come to keep it around. And then again, you have the problem that a yid is going to see this animal over there and think that, hey, you're allowed to sell such animals to goyim. Amar lahen, so Rabbi Yehuda answers them, l'chshetelet, okay, if such an animal gives birth, we'll worry about it. Meaning, in other words, I don't believe such a thing is possible. Alma loy mekabela sachar, which means, in other words, what's the point? Because it's a female animal we're talking about over here, it's not going to be receptive to a male, because most animals, as we talked about previously in Shavuos, most animals mate front to back, the male on the male mounting the female. She needs to be able to bear his weight. If she has a broken leg, she's not going to be able to do that. She's not going to be receptive. Therefore, the goy is not going to bother keeping around a female animal for that purpose. So yeah, the Ravid points out that yes, Rabbi Yehuda might agree. Therefore, a male animal with a broken leg would be a problem because he's on top.
He cannot stand.
It depends which leg we're talking about. I guess whether we're talking front. No, if we're talking a front leg, then yeah. Okay, if it's a front. Yeah, if it's a front leg, then he doesn't support his weight on it so much. But okay, I don't know. Anyway, the point is that the Rabbi Yehuda is arguing. Therefore, it's not so much that the animal, what Tosfos points out, we're not talking about the animal as trefa. It's not necessarily has its leg broken in the place that would make it a trefa, which we established before that an animal that's trefa is never going to be able to give birth to live young. However, here we're not talking about the issue of trefa. We're just talking about the practical fact. It's got a broken leg, so it's not going to be able to bear the weight. Therefore, it's not going to be receptive. But therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says, therefore we can assume that the goy is not going to keep it around for any length of time. He's going to shecht it shortly after.
You couldn't offer such an animal, right?
The goyim probably wouldn't offer such an animal to their getchkas. I mean, they in theory they could. We said before they're only not allowed in mechozer either. They're only not allowed if it's actually missing a limb.
But not just if it's broken.
We couldn't offer it, right? But the goyim mestama could, but not necessarily would they. But that's not the point. We said that was right before the chogas or whatever. Here we're talking about other times. Whereas the Chachamim, either they say, after all, maybe he might manage to get it to work somehow, or the Chachamim say, Tosfos talks about it in a few places in the Sugya, that the problem is, fine, you sold him the animal when it already had a broken leg. Fine, but other people aren't going to realize that it was sold in that condition. Other people are going to think you sold it to him intact, and then it broke its leg after it was by him already. And again, they're going to think that such sales are mutter when they're not. So that's what the Chachamim say. Okay. Then we said in the Mishnah Ben Beseir, and the halacha is like that, right? We said in the Mishnah, Ben Beseira Matir Besulis, Ben Beseira allows you to sell a horse to a guy. Tanya, so we learn in a braise, Ben Beseira Matir Besulis, Mepeshu Oysa by Malacha, Shein Chayavan Aleo Chathas. He allows it with a horse because, as we mentioned on the Mishnah, that anyway, you only use it for the kind of work that is not, that you're not, that that's not considered a malacha on Shabbos. That's not considered a full-fledged malacha. Namely, so Rashi learns we're talking about riding on it, where a person riding on an animal is not a malacha daraisa because a person is able to carry himself. Tosfos talks about that in Shabbos the Gemara explains it somewhat differently. That we're talking if we were talking about a horse for riding, there wouldn't be a machlokes. Everybody agrees that's not a malacha. The malacha is the argument is we're talking about a horse that's used to carry birds, like after you track them.
You can use a horse for racing.
No, obviously. No, we're not saying you're allowed to. It's also Dirabanan. But Daraisa, you're allowed to ride an animal on Shabbos. The whole concept
is for a competition.
I don't know if for a competition. Maybe that's different. But we're talking about, and why not? I mean, there's no actual malacha. That's the point. The malacha would be in the riding on the only malacha would be the riding of the horse itself. And riding a horse itself is not an issur daraisa because chay noisei satsmei, a person is able to carry their own weight. Therefore, in a certain sense, the horse is not accomplishing anything that you couldn't have done it. That person, that someone else, could have carried his own weight.
Yes.
So therefore, that's not considered a malacha. A malacha is only when it couldn't have been done without this thing. for therefore. So Rashi learns like that. Tosfos learns, based on the Gemara in Shabbos, that if we're talking about an animal for riding that people ride on, then for sure there's no reason for a machlokas at all. Even the Chachamim would agree that such a thing is not a malacha. They're talking about, rather, the argument is if we're talking about a horse that's used to carry birds, like after you trapped them or whatever. Ben Beseira and the Chachamim are arguing on the point, when we say Chai Nosei Tatsmei, does it apply only to people, or does it also apply to animals and birds and whatnot? It comes out a practical question also, aside from these dinim that we're talking about over here. If you carry somebody outside on Shabbos, you're potter from a chatas, because again, Chai Nosei Tatsmei. If you carry an animal out on Shabbos, are you chayav a chatas or not? That would be the subject of the machlokas. Okay, so Ben Becerra is saying that you're allowed to sell them a horse because anyway he's not going to be doing anything with it that would be a full fledged malacha on Shabbos. However, Rebbe Oisim of Nebez Dvarim, on the other hand, Rebbe says you're not allowed to sell. Now, the Chachamim in our Mishnah said you're not allowed to sell horses, but Rebbe goes further. Tosfos explains you have three different opinions over here. You have the Chachamim, you have Ben Becerra, and you have Rebbe. Rebbe says that a horse is also for two reasons. Echad Mishim Todas Klei Zayin, number one, because of the rule about weapons, which we were discussing before, which we'll see in a second, Echad Mishim Todas Behema Gasa, and the other reason is because you have the problem with selling them a large animal, which we discussed before. So, let's figure that out. This Shlemas Todas Klei Zayin, I can understand why you should be also to sell them a horse on the grounds of not selling them weapons, Ika Dekotel Beschofe, because you have certain kinds of horses. You have horses sometimes are trained to kill people by stomping on them. When somebody is wounded in battle, for example, they would have, Rashi describes, they'd train the horses to trample them and kill them. Yeah. So I can understand why Rebbe says that therefore you can't sell them a horse because that's the problem with that. Ella Todas Behemagasa Mai. But what is the problem of selling them a large animal? Now, we did say yesterday, of course, that our Mishnah had said you're not allowed to sell them large animals, and we said because of the problem that you may lend it to them, or you may rent it to them, or they may try it out right before Shabbos, and you'll tell it to walk. But if we're talking about an animal for riding, none of those three issues apply, again, because you have the point that it's used for riding, and therefore it's not a malacha d'oraisa. So what's the problem? Rabbi Yechanan said, yes, but there's a different issue. Lichshiyazkin, when such an animal gets old and it's not suitable for riding anymore, matchinoi berechayim, the guy will set the animal to work turning a mill. We're talking about large mills that they had in those days where they'd have them turned by animal power or sometimes by human power or whatever.
They
could use any kind of large animal that's not suitable for other kind of work. Yeah, so therefore they could use an old horse. So there again, you have the same problem that if you're allowed to sell them, that's a malacha, so that is why Rebbe is saying you're not allowed to sell them a horse at all. And the Chachamim therefore are saying, fine, maybe we're not worried about one of those issues, but we're worried about the other, either the weaponry issue or the malacha issue, that matchinei berechayim, and therefore we answer it.
Rebbe is worried about both.
Rebbe is worried about the Chachamim would say maybe one or the other is not an issue. We discussed earlier in the Masech that maybe we're not talking about a war horse. Maybe we're not talking about a war horse, so it's not a problem of trampling. But at any rate, you still have the Matchini Berechayim. So Rav Yechanan says the halacha is like Ben Beseira, you are allowed to sell them a horse. There is actually, though, there is a bit of discussion about that. Does he mean the halacha is like Ben Beseira against both opinions, against Rebbe and against the Chachamim? Or maybe he only means the halacha is like him against Rebbe, but not necessarily against the Chachamim.
He didn't specify.
So yeah, different Rishonim understand it in different ways. The Rambam seems to understand that it means the halacha is not like him relative to the Chachamim, because he talks about in Hilchos Shabbos, he talks about the idea that a horse for a person riding on is not a malacha, but for carrying birds on it is. And according to Tosfos over here, based on the Gemara and Shabbos, Ben Beseira is talking about even a horse for carrying birds. And therefore, the halacha wouldn't be like him, because the fact is, never mind what you do with the horse when it gets old, even when it's young, and you use it for carrying birds, that would already be a malacha d'oraisa. So therefore, it would only mean that the halacha is like him relative to Rebbe. That Rebbe is worried about that what's going to happen when the animal is old, and Rebbe's worried about that it's a war horse and you're going to train it to trample people. It's fine. But to say, so on those grounds, it would be allowed. But on the other hand, you do have the issue if it's the kind of horse used for carrying birds, then you do have an issue, and then the halacha would be like a halacha. Okay. So now we have another question. Sher shel patam mahu. What about, would you be allowed to sell an ox? A fattened ox. So here we're talking about is the ox was fattened up. It's not really, you can't use it for any kind of work. You're fattening it up in order to eventually shecht it and eat it. What would be the din? Are you allowed?
What?
Patam means stuffing. It means that you exactly that. You have a fattened ox. You stuff it full of you stuff it as much as possible full of food, and that way it becomes very big and fat, and then when you eat it, So such an animal is not used for work. Yeah. So mahu, what would be the din? What would be the din with such an animal? Tiboilet of Yehuda, tiboilet abana. And we can ask the question both according to the Yehuda in our Mishnah, who says that you're allowed to sell them an animal with a broken leg, and according to the Chachamim, who say that you can't. Tiboilet of Yehuda. Namely, we can ask according to Rabbi Yehuda, because ad kam lekashori Rabbi Yehuda ela b'shivura. Because Rabbi Yehuda is only allowing it, you could argue, only in the case of an animal with a broken leg, delay ofti lechalam alacha, which is never going to be suitable for work. Avalhai, but when it comes to a fattened ox, right now it's not suitable, but to keep mashile, but if you keep it around, if you decide to unfatten it, to stop feeding it so much, it's not necessarily, ofti lechalam alacha, then you could make it into a work animal. Yeah, so that's the question. In other words, right now you don't have a problem so much of nisyoni, that the goy may want to test it out, whether it's suitable for work, and you're going to call it mechamer on Shabbos. But later on, if it remains in his possession for a long period of time, people are going to think you're allowed to sell them oxen. So the question can be, according to Rabbi Yehuda. Here, if you keep it around long enough, it can be used to work, because you can unfatten it, you can slim it down, and therefore it can be usable for work. Maybe therefore it should be also. So that's the question according to Rabbi Yehuda. Or maybe we could ask the other way around. I feel a little abonon. We could argue like this. Even the abonon like to ask the hotam elva the stomach lav the shchitikari. You could argue the chachamim in our Mishnah don't allow you to sell even an animal with a broken leg, because not necessarily is it something that min hastam they're buying it in order to shech. They could keep it around for some other purpose. Avalhai, the stomach of the shchitakoi, but over here a fattened ox. On the face of it, the standard thing you're going to do with it is shecht it shortly after. After the rabbanon sharu, maybe the rabbanon would agree that such a thing is mutter. So now Tosfos points out, by the way, that before we were talking about an animal with a broken leg, the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda were arguing whether conceivably you could breed it. But that's the thing. Over there, we were talking about conceivably you could breed it. You might keep it around for a long period of time. Here, once you buy such a fattened animal, on the face of it, you're not. Rabbi Yehuda is saying you might keep it around and slim it down and use it for work, but you're not normally going to do that. Normally, you're going to shecht it very shortly after you get it, as opposed to an animal with a broken leg. You might keep it until the next breeding season and try and see if you can make it work. So the question can be either way. Toshma, so come, we'll bring a proof. To Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, shall based Rebbe, the members of Rebbe's household, how you makrivin shor shel patam b'yom edom, they used to have to, they were obligated to bring as taxes or as a present to the king, they were obligated to bring a fattened ox on the goyish chaga, on the yom ed. So what happened? Chosod dalad rivavon shein makrivin oisa hayom ela lamacher. So the Rebbe or his household or whatever were lost. In other words, they paid 40,000 dinarim, I guess, to get the goyim to agree she'en makriven es hayom el lamacha, that they're not going to offer it to their geshka today, but rather tomorrow. Then they paid another 40,000 that they shouldn't have to give them a live animal, but they can give them one that's already shechted. And then they spent yet another 40,000 to get them to agree that they shouldn't have to ever give this present to the king again. So now the point is that the second thing we had is we said that they paid a huge amount of money so that they shouldn't have to give them a live animal but rather a shechted animal. Now we're talking a fattened ox over here. Why would they have bothered spending that much money? My timer, lav mishum duma osi l'shahoyi. Isn't the reason because they were concerned that the goyish governor, whoever, may keep the animal and slim it down. And end up doing work with it on Shabbos. So therefore, that would show. So the answer would be that you're not supposed to, and that is why Rebbe or his family spent that much money in order to bribe the goyim to not require them to have to give them such an animal. Okay. So the Gemara says, however, v'litai meich nu, according to your own svara, according to you yourself are arguing that each of the three things that Rebbe spent all this money on was in order to avoid some problem, in order to avoid something that is also in halacha. But you have to ask, chein makriven oisa hayom el lamacha my time. So what are you gaining by the fact that you're saying that? So according to that, what are you gaining in halacha from the fact that you're saying that this way they won't offer it to their getchka today on the chaga, they'll offer it the next day. The chaga is one day, let's say, but whatever. The point is, what are you gaining by that? Now, of course, you could ask the question, didn't we establish earlier in the perek that when a goy receives a present on his chaga, he's likely to go and thank his getchka, whereas afterwards not, so in that case, they are gaining something. So the Ritva and various other Mephoshim talk about that here it's different. We're talking about a king or a governor or whatever getting a present. They're not so excited by they got one animal that they're going to be so grateful and go and thank their getchka. They get taxes and things like that all the time. It's no big deal to them. So therefore, so that's what the Gemara is asking. If you're telling me that Rebbe got that Rebbe paid them a huge amount of money to bribe them that they shouldn't offer the animal to their getchka on the holiday, but rather the next day, that's not accomplishing anything from a halacha point of view.
On top of that, they could have taken the money in order to do Avodah Zarah.
Well, okay, maybe there's that also. No. Well, again, that's the point the Ritva is making. The taxes and things like that, taxes and bribes and things like that you pay them are not necessarily. We're talking about when we talked before, we're talking about individual goyim. Here we're talking about a governor or a king or whatever. Yeah, fine. But the point still remains that the bribe itself wasn't necessarily given on the chaga itself. That could have been sometime before.
That's the point. It could have been used.
It could have been used, but okay. But where you can't. You have to do business with them sometime. You said you're also to do business with. So fine, this was more than 3 days before, let's say, but whatever. The point is that, so therefore, in other words, the argument is, just like in that case, you're not necessarily accomplishing anything from a halacha point of view by getting them to delay the sacrifice to their getchka by one day, but either way, the issur is still being done. The same way, you can argue the fact that they paid another bribe so that they shouldn't have to give them a live animal, that they should be able to give them a shechted one, is not necessarily for purposes of avoiding something that is also in halacha. Which would then, and we could argue it had a different purpose. Ella, we can argue like this. Rebbe mi'eka milsaboy. Rebbe really wanted to get rid of the whole thing at all. He didn't want. He wanted to be able to convince the goyim to not impose this tax altogether of a fattened ox every year. The sabar. So Rebbe figured ya'akir va'asi porta porta. Let's get rid of it little by little. In other words, he knew that if you try to bite off too much at once, then you're not going to get anything. So instead of trying to give them a bribe that we shouldn't have to do it at all, he tried to do it piecemeal. First, that you shouldn't bring it on your chaga, but rather the next day. That already makes them less likely to bother with it, because then in that case, what do we need? In that case, what do we need a fattened ox from them for? Later on, to improve the situation, that it shouldn't even be a live one. So therefore, they have even less reason to ask for it. And finally, he got to the point where, like this, they're not so wedded to the idea anyway. They're willing to take another 40,000 and abolish the whole tax altogether. So you can't necessarily say that Rebbe was trying to avoid any issue in halacha. He was just trying to get rid of this tax. Basically, tefasta merobalo tefasta. So he did it piecemeal, yeah. Okay, fine. Now, though, the question is, we're asking before, when we went over the various sides of the question, we said there's the possibility that you could keep the animal and slim it down and get it useful for work. That's the question. Is that really so? Are you telling me that if you keep a fattened animal around, then it can become stronger and be able to be suitable for work? Ravashi says, yes. Amali Zvida. Zvida, the name of a person whose job was to fatten up animals like that. Rashi says Patam Hoya, he was one of these kinds of people who fattened up animals for Shchita. So he told me, Bar Torah, an ox that was fattened up, Mashinenlei, if we keep it around and let it slim down, V'ovidah Chad Chrein, it'll work twice as hard as other oxen. So yes, on the contrary, yeah, in its present state, when it's all fattened up, it's not. Yeah, in its present state, when it's fattened up, it's not usable. But if you slim it down, yes, it'll work even harder than it. So what's the bottom line, therefore? So we haven't really come to a conclusion one way or the other.
Probably because the slimming it down is not going to be getting protected. It might as well go back to work.
I don't know, maybe. I don't know if animals think that way psychologically, but okay, it could be. Anyway, we haven't really come to any conclusion. So the Ritva says, about whether you're allowed to sell them a shoroshal pata.
Right.
So the Ritva learns, therefore, that we should be makel, that you are allowed to sell them such an animal.
Right.
On the other hand, the Rambam understands that we concluded, based on what Zvide is saying, that no, you're not allowed to sell it to them because they may keep it around and end up using it for work, and therefore such a thing should be awesome. So we said in a previous part of the Gemara, Tosfos points out over here, that when there's very strong reason to think that they are buying it for purposes of shechting, for example, the customer himself is a butcher who's likely to sheft it soon after, then you're allowed to. But when there's reason to think that he might be keeping it for some length of time, like over here, not for Abed Zara, but for some length of time, and end up doing malacha with it, then it would be slimming it down, for example, then it would be also.
So you need
a strong reason, such as the again that you sold it to a butcher, let's say,
right,
to be allowed to shift it, to be allowed to sell it.
And in the case of slimming it, you would sell it to a.
If you sell it to a butcher, yeah. So that's the thing. If you sell it to a farmer, then you have a problem because he may decide to slim it down. All right. Mishnah says, "In moichum lahem dubin va'arayis, you're not allowed to sell to goyim bears or lions." Or anything else that can cause harm to the public. Because again, we're afraid you sell them any kind of dangerous animal or whatever, we're afraid they may use it to harm people. This, by the way, this and the rest of the things that we're going to talk about in the Mishnah, by the way, hello, there are a couple of reasons behind what we're saying over here. Rashi learns in connection with the next few things in the Mishnah, we're talking about various places that are used for judging criminals or whatever, that the problem is that the person they judge may be a yid, and therefore you're contributing to the death of a yid. Let's learn the rest of the Mishnah, actually, and then I'll explain it better. Ein boinani mahim basilki, you're not allowed to build together with goyim a basilki, which is a fancy type of building. So Rashi learns that what it is, it's sort of like a palace. Yeah, basilki literally means like a king's building or whatever. Yeah, but what? Tira gavoya. Rashi says like a high building, a high palace. Yeah. The point is, Rashi says the problem with it is that when they condemn somebody to execution, they throw them off the top of it.
That's how they used to do it.
That was one way that they did it. So now Rashi learns with this and with the next few things that we mentioned in the Mishnah, the problem is that they may end up judging a Jew to be put to death, and then therefore you're causing that a Jew is being killed. Yeah. You're making it possible to happen. Yeah. On the other hand, there's another explanation. The Ritva says that even if we're not worried about they may catch Jews, even among goyim themselves, they have shevet mitzvos b'nei noach, which includes that they're not allowed to commit murder, and their judicial procedures are not necessarily such honest ones. And in fact, the Meiri talks about over here when we say dina d'malchus dina, he says first of all it doesn't apply to dini nefashis, and even within dini mominus, as far as I know, yeah. So it doesn't apply to dinin nefashis, to say dinin demachos the dinah. Even in dinin mominus, he says it only applies to things like they're allowed to make laws as far as taxation and other financial things like that, but not other kinds of things. But he doesn't elaborate. But the point is that you have the rule of dinin demachos the dinah is very circumscribed. So the bottom line is they. It includes that, so they can make they can impose taxes, things like that.
Civil codes
or whatever, not necessarily is under dinin demachos the dinah. Yeah, what the Me'iri says is not the only opinion. You have other opinions among Rishonim who say that dinin demachos the dinah applies more broadly. The Me'iri himself brings it, but he says that in any case, it certainly doesn't apply to dinin nefashim. So therefore, the point is, the Mishnah says that you have therefore what you have is even if they judge goyim. To be executed in from these basilicas or whatever, then you still have the same problem with lifnei iver. And in fact, Mepharshim points out that the Rambam seems to hold like both of these opinions because he brings these halachas twice: once in Hilchos Avodah Zarah in connection with things that you're not allowed to do business with goyim, and another one in Hilchos Yitzeach, implying that the Rambam understands there's a dual reason for it: one, because of the problem that you're making it possible for a goy to kill another goy. And therefore, it's in the same category as the other dinim that we're talking about over here in our parak of lifnei iver. And the other, because you're making it possible for them to kill Jews, as Raki is saying over here, and therefore that belongs in Hilchos Ritzeh.
I think that happened, since you're mentioning it, I think that happened in Bukhara. The Jews build these huge towers in which they used to serve people, and when they executed them.
Could be. Well, according to our Mishnah, they're not allowed to do that. Okay, so you're not allowed to build a basilki. Gardrum. You're also not allowed to build a gardrum, which is also like a high platform that they use for judging condemned criminals. In modern Hebrew, they use the word gardrum to mean a scaffold, like what they person up to be hanged on.
The gallows.
Yeah, well, yeah, not the gallows itself, but the platform the gallows is on, whatever. Yeah, okay. It's stadia, also a stadium where they have bullfights and things like that, where they throw condemned people into there to be gored by the bulls or
a coliseum.
Yeah, well, it was built by slave labor, by Jewish slave labor. Yeah, in modern Hebrew, it's stadion, means a stadium. Yeah, they came from Greek. Yeah. Oh, bima, and you're also not allowed to build together with them a bima, which is another type of platform. Again, Rashi says it's the same kind of thing that they use to throw condemned people off. You have different other explanations among the Farshim of what exactly these four things are. In particular, the Eri, I think it is, brings an explanation who says that these four are four different levels of Goyish courts. Like they start at the Basilki and then the next higher court, the Court of Appeals from that is the Gardrum, and the next one after that is the Stadia, and then the top one is the Bima.
No, that's the second door. He built all the towers in Manhattan.
Okay, anyway. Fine, but they don't throw people off those towers nowadays. Okay. So you're not allowed to build these things with them. Again, either because of the problem that Jews are going to end up being executed from them, or that Goyim, and therefore you have a problem with Lifnei, or both. However, you are allowed to build together with goyim bimusios. So Rashi understands that bimusios are pedestals. Actually, Rashi uses the word altar, which the goyim use for bringing korbanos to their getchkes. And why is that allowed? Rashi says because it's only a tashmish of avodah zarah. The altar itself is built, and then they're able to use it as a place to shecht animals in honor of their getchkes. So therefore, it's not a direct thing of avodah zarah; it's sort of an indirect thing. That's how Rashi. Okay, Rashi learns that that's allowed. Rashi learns that you're allowed to build such a thing. Bima shel evan achas u'makriv zvachim. Rashi says it's a single stone set up as a pedestal, as a pillar, and they bring korbanos on it to their getchkes. It's a tashmish of a tashmish of avodah zarah, says Rashi. And in the side over here, I go to Yonim, adds from Rashi on Rif and from some other Rishonim, that the point is, at the time when it's being built, it's not yet being used to avodah zarah. And then there's another gear set that the Nemuka Yosef brings, that they don't actually sacrifice on it. What they do is they use it as a place to put a pan full of keturas. So therefore, again, it's an indirect thing. The altar is a place on which they put a pan. On top of the pan on which they put incense, which they offer to their avodah zarah. So therefore, it's an indirect thing. Therefore, it's allowed. Tosfos argues with that on Amud Beis, and Tosfos argues, how can you say such a thing? A bimus like that should indeed be osur, just because, and even you're going to argue with a tashmish of a tashmish, that doesn't really work. So therefore, Tosfos brings that, Tosfos accepts, therefore, the girsa of the aruch, which is the word isn't bimusais, but dimusais. Dimusais means that. So therefore, you're allowed to build bathhouses with them, because fine, and there's no issue of avodah zarah, and no issue of public, and no issue of danger. The Jews are to go. So you're allowed to build with them that. And by the way, this machlokas between Rashi and Tosfos ends up being, it's interesting, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva on the question, is a Jewish architect allowed to prepare blueprints of a church? So like this, they ask him to draw up blueprints for a church.
What about a Jewish architect for blueprints of a church?
Why should that be awesome?
He's got to ask his first.
Yeah, okay. So a Jewish architect putting together, so Rav Moshe talks about it at some length over here, and he brings the discussion over here. If we're saying that Tashmish to Tashmish is, if we're saying, like Rashi, that Tashmish is water, then maybe even, never mind the blueprint, you might even be allowed to join in building the church itself. The church itself is not an object of worship, it's just a place in which they worship. On the other hand, if you go with Tosfos, fine, the building itself would be awesome. But the blueprints is already too far from it, especially because they could conceivably build without blueprints, and therefore he ends up saying it is mutter. Obviously, if you have a way to avoid it, so much the better, but you are allowed to, he says. Okay. Anyway. So you're allowed to build. Okay. So you're allowed to build. No, if you do the blueprints, that's the same as the actual building. Okay. Anyway. So Rashi says that it's bimusios, which is altars, and Tosfos and the Aruch and everybody else says it's bimusios, which are bathhouses. Well, base mechatzos, and you also allow base mechatzos are definitely bathhouses. So the difference is that would be an open air bathhouse, whereas a base mechatzos would be a building. Tosfos also mentions on a base just that dimusios means more generally a building, not for avodah zarah purposes. In Greek you have the word demos, we get the word democracy and a bunch of other words from it. So demosos conceivably could mean a building meant for the people's use, in other words, not necessarily for avodah zarah, just a public building.
Like Congress or something.
Yeah, let's say. So you're allowed to build such buildings with that. However, higia l'kipa shemamin ba'avodas kochavim, once you get to the point in the building where you get to the dome or the niche where they would put a statue, and it was very common, we'll see later on in the Masechta, it was very common in bathhouses to put a statue of some getchka. Then that part, also live nice, that niche or that dome, you're not allowed to build, but you're allowed to build the rest of the building.
But it's not a simple statue that you're
going to build. No, you're not actually putting a statue there at all. We're talking about the niche,
the niche.
Dome where they would place the statue.
But if it has to be a statue of Avodah Zarah.
Yeah, obviously. So we'll deal with later on in the Masechta. We're going to deal with, in the third parak, we're going to deal with what kind of statues are considered just decorative and therefore mutar b'hana versus what kind are considered objects of worship and also b'hana. So we'll get to that. Fine. So the Gemara starts off. Omer of Chanan bar Chista, ba'amila Omer of Chanan bar Rava Omer Rav. So of Chanan bar Chista, or some say of Chanan bar Rava says in the name of Rav. Since we mention in our Mishnah, well, this is going to be a side thing, which then we're going to tie back to our Mishnah. Now, so we have as background, like we have like this. There's a din that when you shecht an animal, so normally you shecht an animal, no problem. Afterwards, it's dead; it doesn't move anymore. That's it.
Absolutely.
However, you can, well, you have a situation. You can hold on. You can have a situation where an animal before you shechted it was dangerously sick. It wasn't sick with anything that would make it a trefa, but it was old and weak or whatever. Now, there you have a problem, because after you shecht it, if it doesn't move, how do you know that the shchita is what actually killed it? It might have died at some earlier point. It might have died before you started the shchita, or before you got far enough in the shchita for it to be a kosher shchita. So then you need that the animal does some movement after the shchita to show that there's still some life force left in it, it can move, convulse.
Reflexive movements?
That's what we're talking about, reflexive movements. But in other words, that it still had enough life force in it to be able, that it's able to move around. Well, so how much movement do you need? So the Gemara in Cholin discusses that there's a difference in that regard between small animals like sheep and goats versus large animals like cows. The difference is that with small animals, you need, for example, so if you're up with a small animal, with a sheep, let's say, so again, if it was dangerously sick, You shafted it, and then let's say it just moves one of its forelegs outward. That's not considered enough. The kind of movement we need is called piercus. Just doing like that is not enough because that's just basically the muscles relaxing. That doesn't show that it had any life in it before it was shafted. You would have to have that it puts out its arm and brings it back in, all convulsively, of course. The animal's already been shafted. But the point is that it still has the muscles, the nerves, or whatever, are still working enough for it to be able to do like that. With a behemoth gasa, on the other hand, with a cow, with a bull, whatever, you don't need that. All you need, it's enough that it does like that. Just an outward movement. That's considered enough here. Now, that's all talking about domestic animals. What about wild animals? What's it in? What about, for example, deer or buffalo or what have you? So, Amar Rav Chanan bar Chisda Amila, Amar Rav Chanan bar Rava, Amar Rav, Chaya gasa, a large wild animal, for example, a buffalo, it has the same status as a small domestic animal, like a sheep, as far as pirkus. In other words, the same way as a sheep, we say it has to be able to do both out and in. The same way with the same, that's called that, and only that is considered pirkus. Otherwise, if it only goes out, it's called haithas nefesh, and that's not considered enough. The animal is a nevela. With a chaya gasa, for example, a buffalo, the same din would apply. You'd have to have like this and like this. Out and in. That, right. In order for it to be considered pirkus. Aval lo lemechira. However, Rav Chanan bar Rav Chisda or Rav Chanan bar Rava is saying in the name of Rav that is not true as far as selling. When we said in the previous Mishnah that there are places where the minhag was that you allowed to sell small animals to goyim but not large animals, there we don't say that large wild animals like buffalo are the same as small domestic animals. So even in places where the minhag is that you're allowed to sell them sheep, you're not allowed to sell them buffalo. So in other words, again, a buffalo has the same din as far as a sheep when it comes to pirkus, but not as far as mechira. The same way as you're not allowed, regardless of even in places where you're allowed to sell them sheep, in no place we said you're allowed to sell them cows and bulls. By the same token, you're not allowed to sell them buffalo or other large wild animals. Then he says, "Va'ani omer af l'mechira." However, Rav Chanan bar Rava himself says, "No, I disagree with that." And I say, even when it comes to selling, makom shenagu limkom b'chun, in places where the minhag is that you're allowed to sell them sheep and goats, then you're also allowed to sell them buffaloes. Makom shaloi limkom ain b'chun, in places where the minhag is that you're not allowed to sell them sheep, then you're not allowed to sell them buffalo either. Okay. Now let's look at our Mishnah and see which of those two opinions it can fit with. We said ein mochel man dubim ba'arayis. We said in our Mishnah, you're not allowed to sell to goyim bears or lions, v'loy kol davar sheyesh bein nezek l'davim, or anything else that can cause harm to the public because they're wild animals. What? Rob tigers, panthers, yeah, whatever.
Eagles.
I guess eagles as well. Yeah. I don't know. Okay. Taima de'is bein nezek l'davim. Now, what's the implication? Why you're not allowed to sell them a bear or a lion? Because it could be dangerous. Implying if it's not a problem of danger, meaning, in other words, it actually says, even so for example, we're talking about, let's say, a tame lion, you would be allowed to sell them. Well, then, by the same logic, you should be allowed to sell them. You should be allowed to sell them a buffalo. So, therefore, that would prove Rav Chanan bar Rava's point that you're allowed to sell them buffalo in places where other chayagasa, in places where the minig is to sell them.
Could be very dangerous.
They could be, but ordinarily they're not. And the same thing, the same way as we're saying. A lion normally is dangerous, but if you have a tame one, then you're allowed to. So the same way, okay.
A lion is dangerous?
Yeah, okay. Well, that's what we're assuming for purposes of the question. Okay. Rav Ba'ula says not necessarily, because when the Mishnah is implying that you're allowed to sell them lions under certain conditions, when there's no danger, that's not talking about a tame lion. It's talking about Bari Shover. It's talking about a lion with a broken leg, which is therefore not dangerous. It can't move. Ba'ali b'dir of Yehuda, and therefore would go with the Yehuda, who said that when it came to cattle, you're allowed to sell them cattle with broken legs, and the same thing, you're allowed to sell them a lion with a broken leg. So therefore, no proof, therefore, that you would be allowed to sell them an intact lion that is domesticated. Therefore, no proof that you would be allowed to sell them a buffalo. Rav Ashi
says, here's a different answer.
You don't even have to say the Mishnah is talking about a lion with a broken leg. You could always say, Sam Ari, Shavu Hu'ei Samalacha. A lion is considered broken relative to Malacha, in the sense, you can't do the lion for Malacha.
But then, you know, who says that you're allowed to sell them cattle with a broken leg would say you're allowed to sell them any kind of lion. Because the same way as cattle with a broken leg, you're not going to be able to do wood with it. And Rabbi Huda, as we said on Amar Aleph, is not considered that you're going to use it because he says it's not going to be able to, you're not going to be able to physically. He would say, because damage, by the same logic, he would say you're allowed to sell them a lion because a lion can't be used for wood either. So therefore, there's no problem of Sabbath. And you're not going to have that. You're going to that other people are going to see the lion by him and say, "Hey, you're also allowed to sell them. You're also allowed to sell them cattle," because people will realize the obvious difference: cattle you do malacha with, and lions you don't. As opposed to the chachamim might say the same way as you're not allowed to sell them an ass with a broken leg, they could also say that you're not allowed to sell them a lion either. So therefore, it's a no proof. The Chachamim, because we said before, because the Chachamim say we're not making a distinction. Once we say you're also to sell them large animals, and that's it. It applies to all of them. Tosfos actually argues differently than Rashi. Tosfos argues that it's one thing with an animal with a broken leg. People might think you sold it to him before it broke its leg, and therefore they're going to think you're allowed. A lion, obviously, it can never do work. A lion is a wild animal, and you can't get work out of it. Therefore, there's no reason. Even the Chachamim might agree that you're allowed to sell them lions again, unless you have the issue of danger. So when there's no issue of danger, then you would be allowed to.
Is there no issue of danger?
So again, we said we could be talking about a tamed lion. Or we could be talking about where you sell it to him and he keeps it in a cage or whatever. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. All right. The Gemara says, "Maybe though, I have a contradiction against Rav Chanan bar Rava, again, who said that you are allowed to sell goyim large wild animals such as buffalo or lions for that matter." Braisa says, "Kishem she'en merchem mehem behem agasa." Just as we said in the previous Mishnah, you're not allowed to sell them large domesticated animals like cattle. Kach ein merchem and chaya gasa. So also, you're not allowed to sell them large wild animals. The afilu b'makom shemerchem mehem behem in places where the minhag is to sell them small domesticated animals, sheep and goats. Even in such places, chaya gasa ein merchem mehem, you're still not allowed to sell them large wild animals like buffalo. Okay, Kyovta, yes, it's a contradiction, and therefore it can't be like him, that the halacha has to be like what Rav said, that that buffalo and other large wild animals are like the hemadaka as far as pirkus, as far as the movement after shchita, but not as far as selling. As far as selling, they're in the same category as cattle and horses and whatnot. Okay. Continues the Gemara. Ravina Rami Masnissin Abraisa Umashan. Ravina pointed out a contradiction between the Mishnah, between our Mishnah, and the Braisa that we just quoted, and then he showed how they don't contradict each other. Between our Mishnah and the Braisa we just quoted, he pointed out that on the face of it you have a contradiction between them, and he showed how to explain it so they don't contradict each other. We learned in our Mishnah in Merchalan, Dumu Radayas, for like called Davashesh, but Nezakol Rab. We said you're not allowed to sell them bears and lions or anything else that could harm the public. Implying, Taima de Isbe Nezak. The only reason you're not allowed to sell them to them is because of the problem of danger. Ha Lesbe Nezak Merchalan, implying if there's no problem of danger, then you should be allowed to. Urmini, but then we have a contradiction from the Braisa, which said Shem Shein Merchin Behem Agasa, Kachin Merchin Chaya Gasa, just as you're not allowed to sell them large domestic animals, so you're not allowed to sell them large wild animals. Ba'afilu b'mokim shemerchin behem adaka, and even in places where you sell them small domestic animals, Chaya Gasa Ein Merchin, you're not allowed to sell them large wild animals. So therefore, from the Braisa, it comes out as a blanket prohibition on selling them lions or bears or whatever, whereas from the Mishnah, it seems to imply only when there's a problem of danger. So how do you reconcile that? Well, Mishani and Ravina answered Bari Shova Rali B'Dirbi Oda. So he answered, like the Gemara answered before,
that we're talking about that our Mishnah is talking about selling them a lion with a broken leg, an injured lion, Rali B'Dirbi Oda, and therefore our Mishnah would be only a coincidence of Yehuda, whereas the Braisa that says you can't sell them any large wild animals would be a coincidence of the Chachamim, who don't make that distinction. And again, Rav Ashi says the same answer as he said before. Stamari shavu hoetz malacha. A lion is considered broken, is considered injured relative to malacha because you can't get work out of a lion. So therefore again, according to Rashi, right? So yeah.
So therefore, according to Rashi, Rabbi Yehuda would always say it's mutter, regardless whether the lion is physically injured or not. The Chachamim would say it's aser. And according to Tosfos, maybe the Chachamim would agree when it comes to a lion that it's mutter, because there's no way that anybody is going to confuse it with cattle and say that if you're allowed to sell them a lion, you're allowed to sell them cattle. Okay, so basically the same thing as we said before, but the point is before we use the Braisa to refute what Rav Chanan Bar Rava said, here we're just pointing out the basic fact that anyway we have that even if we didn't have Rav Chanan Bar Rava's issue, even if we didn't have his statement, we would still have to reconcile the Mishnah and the Braisa anyway, and understand again that either one is a coin of Yehuda and the other is a coin of the Chachamim, or that there's a difference between cattle or other, or we're going to see later in the Gemara also, there are other wild animals that you can get work out of. So those kind, again, would be subject to the same rules as domestic animals. But a lion that's not usable for work, we could say again, according to Rashi, Rabbi Yehuda would say for sure it's allowed, whether it's injured or not. And according to Tosfos, even the Chachamim would say that a lion you'd be allowed to sell them. Again, as long as there's no issue of danger. An elephant is different. An elephant you can get work out of.
Yeah.
An elephant you can get work out of, but again, that would get into the question of what Ben Becerra was saying before about animals for riding. An elephant normally you use for riding.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's not an issue of malacha. Therefore, it's not an issue of malacha on Shabbos.
Yeah, you can use for both.
What? What else would you use an elephant?
Ride, and you can use it for work.
Oh, they lift heavy loads.
Okay, if it's the kind of place where they use elephants to carry heavy loads, then I guess it would be in the same category as other wild animals that you can use for work. We're not talking about that. We're talking about we're talking about lions that you can't use for work versus other kinds of wild animals. As we're going to see, the Gemara is going to give soon an example of a wild donkey that you could. Maske for Rav Nachman. However, then Rav Nachman asks on the whole premise. You're assuming throughout this whole argument that a lion is considered a chayagasa. But man le malon da'ari chayagasa. Who says b'chlal that a lion is considered a large wild animal? Doma chayadaka. Maybe it's considered a small wild animal.
A lion?
First of all, large and small. I don't know. First of all, there are different sizes of lions. But the truth. Okay, you know what, Avram Moshe, the truth is, lions in general weigh a couple hundred pounds at most, whereas, for example, for example, you have horses, donkeys, or whatever that are fairly large, built animals. And they weigh more. Yeah, a lion actually compared to an elephant. No, obviously we're not talking about. But among wild animals themselves, the lion is. Lions are not exactly tip the scale among the heavier ones. They're fierce animals and they're the king of the jungle and all that. But they're not necessarily among the larger animals. So therefore, Rav Nachman is saying that you're arguing all this time that we have a problem between the Mishnah and the Braisa. And for that matter, that we were arguing before against Rav Chanan Bar Rava, that the Mishnah is saying you're not allowed to sell them lions, but the Braisa is that you're allowed to sell them lions where there's no problem of danger. The Braisa is saying you're not allowed to sell them chayagasa at all, and we're assuming there's a contradiction, and we're using that whole issue to refute Rav Chanan Bar Rava. But maybe actually a lion is a chayadaka. Is a chayadaka, is a small wild animal, and therefore that would take apart everything we said so far. Okay. However, Rav Ashi dayik masnisir umosiv tiyufa. So now Rav Ashi says, never mind the braisa. Just from looking at the Mishnah itself, we can refute what Rav Chanan Bar Rava said, namely. We said in the Mishnah that we said in the Mishnah that you're not allowed to sell them, you're not allowed to sell them bears or lions or anything else that would cause danger to the public, implying time of the ispe nezek or lespe nezek. Again, like we said before, that implies you're not allowed to sell where there's a problem of danger. You're allowed to sell where there's no problem of danger. And by the way, I forgot to mention before, some Mepharshim say the same logic as we said before, that you're allowed to sell goyim weapons when they use it for defense. Well, by the same logic, if they use lions and bears to defend the city, then you would be allowed to sell it to them. So that would be an example where there's no way there's not nezek or not. So, the time ari, now continues Ravashi, though, look at it like this. The Mishnah is specifically mentioning lions and bears, for that matter, distam ari, shavuhu etz malacha, where, as we said before, as Ravashi said, that a lion is considered injured relative to malacha in the sense that you can't really get any useful work. Not so much you can't tame it, you can't really get any useful work out of a lion, yeah. But the implication would seem to be that other kinds of wild animals from which you could get work out of, from which you could get out of them malacha, that is also on Shabbos, then you would not be allowed to.
If what?
The very fact, now, what Ravashi is pointing out like this, if the Mishnah just meant to say as a general statement that you're not allowed to sell them any large animals, then instead of mentioning specifically lions and bears, the Mishnah should have just said generically that you're not allowed to sell them any animal that could cause danger to the public. Why bother mentioning specifically lions and bears? Therefore, Ravashi says, the implication is the Mishnah is mentioning lions and bears because those are in a category of their own, that you can't get malacha out of them. Therefore, the only reason to ask they're selling them is because of the problem of nezek. If there's no problem of nezek, you're allowed to sell them,
right,
as opposed to other wild animals which can be used for malacha, which can be used for work. Those you would not be allowed to sell, because there might not be a problem of nezek, but again, there's a problem of malacha. So therefore, from that thing itself, never mind the Braisa, the Mishnah itself is implying that there's a difference between animals that can be used for work and not. Tiyuv to Rav Chanan bar Rava. Therefore, that's a contradiction. Again, that's again a contradiction against Rav Chanan bar Rava, who said that you're allowed to sell them large wild animals, even, and he didn't distinguish whether they can be used for work or not. We see that's not like that, because we see from the on Mishnah itself that only the kind that can't be used for work are you allowed to sell them, under certain circumstances, but the kind that can be used for work, you can't, and therefore that's it. And that means that's how it is.
Within that category, very well.
Yeah.
I think that's the contradiction.
Yes. Yeah. So now the question is, v'chayagasa miyas naim alocha abda. Fine, but the bottom line is, what kind of work do you get out of a large wild animal? Omer Abaya says, I'll tell you. Omerli Mar Yehuda told me, Dve Mar Yuchni, at the household of Mar Yuchni, Tachni rechayim ba'aroidi. They use for grinding, for turning the grinding mill, wild donkeys. And Aroid is a wild donkey. So therefore we see that there are large wild animals like that can be used for malacha.
They're not very large donkeys, they're not large animals. They're smaller than a lion.
Okay, so actually I shouldn't really say wild donkey. I mean, there's a proper name for it. The animal is called in English an onager, or I don't know how it's pronounced exactly, whatever. It's a subspecies of donkey. It's maybe more like a zebra or whatever, but whatever. It's a largish animal. But the point is, they're wild animals, they're not domesticable, but in this case, in Bar-Yuchni's household, they were able to capture one and make it, and then make it do this work of turning the millstone. So that would be the kind of thing, therefore, that the Mishnah is implying that you're not allowed to sell to a goy under any circumstances because of the problem of malacha, as we discussed before. When it comes to lions and bears, which you can't get malacha out of them, the only issue is danger, and therefore, if you're selling them in a situation where it's not dangerous, then you would be allowed to.
Even in a cage, if it's intact.
So again, what the definition would be where there's no danger, we'd have to figure out. Does it mean that the animal is injured or otherwise can't? Does it mean that? Does it mean that it's in a cage? Does it mean you're selling it to somebody responsible, et cetera? Yeah. Okay. All right. Omer Rav Zera.
He has been in Beit Rav Yehuda. But Rav Zera says, when I was in Rav Yehuda's yeshiva, now Rav Yehuda was the Rav Yeshiva in Babel, because he's in Talmud Yisra. He is both by Rav and by Shmuel. Rav Zera is telling over years later, when he's in Eretz Yisrael, he tells what happened. Rav Yehuda tells us one time,
Gmiru minoi ha-milsa, learn from me the following halacha, demigabri rabba shmieli, because I heard this halacha from a great person, However, and he's going to say what the halacha is in a minute, but Rav Zera interjects, I don't know what Rav Yehuda said, who he said he heard it from, whether from Rav or from Shmuel. Again, because he learned by both. What is the halacha? As we said before, chaya gasta harei ki behem adakal apirkus. That when it comes to pirkus, the movement after shechita, a large wild animal, like a buffalo, is treated the same way as a small domestic animal, like a sheep. Yeah. Has to be back and forth movement. Ki asori l'kukunya, then continues Rav Zera, when I went to Kukunya, the name of a place in Babel,
I found Rav Kiva Ashi sitting and saying the din in the name of Shmuel, Chaya Gasta Hari Tadam Adakal Pirkus, this same din that I heard before from the Yoda. So I thought to myself, okay, Shmuel, I'm going to Shmuel in that. Okay, good, that shows. Now I have my answer. When the Yoda said I heard it from a great person, and I didn't remember which of the Zubay and Yoda, it must have been Shmuel. On the other hand, so it was Surah, then continues with Zera. When I went to Surah, I found Rabbi Yirmiya, the Yosef of Kamal and Shmei the Rav, that he was sitting and saying this din in the name of Rav. So now I thought to myself, it's both. The Yehuda had heard this din from Rav and from Shmuel. That's why I wasn't sure before which one he heard it from. But in fact, he heard it from both of them.
In one place, he heard it
in the name of Shmuel, in another place, he heard it in the name of Rav. They put two and two together and realized that Rav and Shmuel must have independently agreed, must have agreed there, and each of them independently thought that the order was there
at a different time. Okay. Then continues Rav Zera, so far, so good. So we know that Rav and Shmuel both said it. However, Ki Slaika Flahasam, then when I went to there, to Eretz Yisrael,
Ashkafti Lilabasi, then I found Slaika things I went up.
So I found Rav Asi, the Yosef Kama, that he was sitting and saying this halacha as follows: Amar Rav Chama bar Guria Meshmei de Rav, Chaya Gasta Harei Ki Behem Adakal Pirkus.
Is higher
than Lebanon? Yeah, it's higher than Babel. Higher than Babel. Yeah, okay. In general, we say Eretz Yisrael Gavoya Mikol Arutz. Eretz Yisrael is higher than the other countries in Ruchnius and also whatever. Okay. Anyway. So Rav Asi was saying that Rav Chama bar Guria said in the name of Rav. Amrilei, so Rav Zera says to him. So Rav Zera says, I said to him, V'loi sovel amar d'man mora d'shmaitzer Rav bar Yirmiya. Don't you agree that the one who is the owner of this halacha is Rav bar Yirmiya? Because that's who I heard it from in the name of Rav. So why are you quoting in the name of Rav Chama bar Guria? Amalei, and Rav Asi answered, Tafya Uchma, Black Kaili.
Now, why is he calling them that? Rashi says, because he meant it actually as a compliment.
He meant, you're a great Talmud Chacham. You're so busy, you're so caught up all the time in learning Torah that you don't really take care of your appearance. So therefore, it was like an affectionate term that the Chachamim would use for each other. Tafya Uchma, you Black Kaili.
No, he wasn't physically black. He meant you're black in the sense that you don't bother taking care of your appearance because you're too focused in learning Torah. Okay. The back of Emden adds that specifically Rav Zera, we say, yeah, the same that Rav Zera fasted
many fasts in order to forget the Talmud Bavli, so he could learn Talmud Yerushalmi, and the fasting also made him look black and unattractive. So in that case, all the more so, Rav Asi is sort of complimenting on that. Look how much you're sacrificing for learning Torah.
Between you and me, we'll get to the bottom of it. In other words, now we have the complete chain of it. That Rav said the din,
and then Rav Chama bar Guria, who I'm quoting it in the name from, learned it from him. Rabba bar Yirmiya, who you said heard it from Rav. He didn't hear it directly from Rav. He heard it from Rav Chama bar Guria, and so now we have the whole chain. Rav. Rav Chama bar Guria, Rav bar Yirmiya, and now you and me. Itmar Nami, and in fact they said also that this is the complete chain. Omer Rav Zera, Omer Rav Asi, Omer Rav bar Yirmiya, Omer Rav Chama bar Guria, Omer Rav, Chaya Gasa Harei Kebehem Adakal Pirkus. So that's it. So that's the whole chain, and therefore now it's clear who said what. And aside from that, we said also the Shmuel also agreed to this din also, and Rabbi Yehuda heard it from him as well. Yeah.